is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Two detectives made Dwayne Davis a promise. Dwayne Davis is Keith E.D., the man on trial for the murder of Tupac Shakur. The promise was made in 2008. Tupac, by the way, died in 1996. One of them said it out loud on tape. And this is kind of why we're here today, because Dwayne Davis, Keith E.D., well, he believed it. He believed what the officers told him. Now, what he revealed, and the weight of it is like, well, I don't know that we can keep that a secret. And who made the promise and what the restrictions on that promise are really are the whole reason there's a trial going on. Because Keith E.D. thought, well, I can say whatever I want now. Whether that's making things up, he argues, or it's telling his truth. As he once strongly argued in books, on podcasts, in interviews, anywhere anyone would listen and provide a little payday. And one of them said it out loud on this tape that was played in court. Nothing you say today can be used against you. That's where we're at. That's where the crux of a lot of this case is. Another voice on the recording went further. Nothing leaves this room. Gee, I wonder why people are hesitant to testify or reveal information on these cases in this world. On day four of Davis's murder trial in Las Vegas, that recording played through the courtroom speakers. The jury deciding whether he dies in prison heard every word of the promise. Some people in the gallery shook their heads as it played. Tupac Shakur's family sat still and listened. The detectives weren't there to ask Davis about Tupac at all, and the story he told them wasn't the story he'd given the government the first time. They asked. Jurors watched a transcript roll across the screen while the audio played, some of them taking notes. What they heard was Davis in his own voice describing the night of September 7th, 1996. Four men ride in a white Cadillac near the Las Vegas Strip. They spot Shakur hanging out of a black BMW, people on the sidewalk calling his name, Suge Knight, the driver's seat. The Cadillac pulls up alongside, and Shakur's car sits on the opposite side from Davis. If we would have been on my side, I would have blasted. That's the defendant on tape to police saying he would have shot Tupac if the car had been on the opposite side. It was the first time Davis ever discussed his involvement in the killing with authorities. Instead, Davis said he passed his gun to the back seat. He handed it to DeAndre Big Dre Smith, who did not want it. And Davis's nephew, Orlando Baby Lane Anderson, took the weapon and started firing. Davis said he figured Knight died too. Knight survived. Tupac was 25 years old and he died 6 days later. Davis, now 63, this crime now 30 years ago, is charged with murder with a deadly weapon with a gang enhancement, and he faces life in prison if convicted. He's pled not guilty. Prosecutors told the jury at openings that Davis never pulled the trigger. They allege he planned the shooting, as revenge for the beating his nephew took from Shakur's entourage at the MGM Grand hours earlier, after Anderson Orlando, the trigger man, allegedly snatched a death row chain off a man in Shakur's circle. Remember the death row chains? Davis was at the Mike Tyson fight that night, but wasn't part of the brawl. The jury has already watched the beating on video. You may have watched it if you followed this case sometime in the last 30 years. For 30 years, the argument about this case has been about who fired the shots. The jury doesn't need that answer because Davis isn't accused of shooting anyone. The indictment lays out the state's theory in layers. Davis allegedly killed Shakur or aided in the killing by obtaining a gun and handing it to someone else, or conspired to carry it out. The burden is the plan and the weapon. The tape has Davis describing both. The hunt for Shakur's car, the gun moving from his hand towards the back seat, and what he says he'd have done if the angle had been his. The most famous question in hip-hop history was always aimed at the wrong seat of the Cadillac. Here's why any of this exists on tape. The detectives in that 2008 room were part of a task force investigating a different murder, the killing of the notorious B.I.G. Davis had briefly been a suspect in that case before investigators moved on. Everybody was a suspect at the time. Darren Dupree, one of the detectives from the interview, testified to that at trial. Davis walked in to talk about one murder, and he handed them a different one. It also wasn't the first story he'd given the government. In 1998, in a proffer session, and in a 1999 prison interview, Davis told the FBI he had nothing to do with Shakur's death, according to testimony from a former agent. He said his nephew wasn't involved either, and he pointed toward New York, toward people connected to Sean Combs. Those FBI sessions were never audio recorded. The agent testified, so they survive only as written reports. The 2008 interview is the one with the voice. So the same man gave the government opposite accounts of the same murder, and none of it happened under oath. His lawyer told the jury the prosecution's narrative is fiction. He said there are no facts pointing to his client, and the police never charged Davis years ago because they knew he was, in his lawyer's words, full of crap. The state's answer is the strange part. Prosecutors agree that Davis lies. They're asking the jury to decide which time he told the truth. Is it when it's convenient for us, or is it over here when it's not? You decide. Dupree handed them that argument from the witness stand. He testified that he believed in the 2008 account because Davis put the gun in his own nephew's hand. Anderson had been dead 10 years by then, killed in a 1998 shootout, never charged with anything. Dupree's reasoning? No uncle puts that on a dead nephew's name unless it's true. The state had this tape in 2008. The indictment didn't come till September of 23, and the promise is the reason. That proffer agreement legally blocked police from building charges out of what Davis said in that room. The relationship went further than protection. Dupree testified the task force signed Davis up as a confidential informant in 2009 and traveled with him to New York. Davis later called the arrangement the deal of a lifetime. Then the room started leaking, and Davis leaked it second. Greg Kading, one of the detectives on that tape, published a book in 2011 that revealed details from the protected interview. Documentaries later aired portions of it. The words that were supposed to stay in that room circled in print for years while Davis remained uncharged. Davis eventually joined in. Well, if they're talking about it, can't I? He sat for a BET documentary in 2018 and described the fatal shots coming from the back seat, keeping the shooter's name, he said, for the code of the streets. Although walking right up to revealing it. In February 2019, he published a memoir describing his desire for retaliation, obtaining a pistol and searching the strip for Shakur. Then came the paid interviews, repeating all of it. Prosecutors say that's what killed his protection. Their position, the agreement, covered the room, and Davis shredded it in public, voluntarily, for money. The defense says those sessions were meant to stay confidential and that the book was dramatized to sell copies with no way to know which parts Davis even wrote. The judge sided with the state before trial. The jury gets the book, the interviews, and the tape itself, though she said she had some concerns about the legality of admitting the proffer statements. Even Shakur followed the code Davis couldn't keep. A former officer testified that he rode in the ambulance and kept asking the dying rapper who shot him. Shakur refused to say, telling him, "We'll take care of it." At opening statements, a prosecutor told the jury that few people have ever been willing to talk about the killing, and that Davis is the one person who has a hard time being silent. That line carries more weight than anything physical the state owns. There's no gun evidence, no Cadillac, and every other man from that car is dead. The case is Davis's mouth, plus 15 years of proof that he couldn't keep it closed. Which leaves this jury with a strange job. Both sides agree the defendant is unreliable. The state needs jurors to believe he told the truth once, in one room in 2008. The defense doesn't need him to believe that everything from the tape to the documentary to the book was a performance for whoever was happened to be paying. The tape puts Davis in front of the passenger seat of the Cadillac. Davis has publicly insisted he's innocent and says he was home in Los Angeles that night. Those two claims can't share a verdict. So the jury has to pick which version of the same man it believes. In 2008, two detectives promised Duane Davis that nothing would leave that room. All of it left. Through a detective's book, through Davis's own, and finally through courtroom speakers, into a room where Tupac Shakur's family sat listening to the accused describe that night in his own voice. Will they convict? Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. You know, you go back to the proffer agreement. Should that have ever left? Should there be more stipulations on proffer agreements? I think a lot of attorneys would agree there should be. But is there, and is our proffer agreements just basically like a, well, let's not rattle the cage here after we've walked away from it. Maybe, because you rattle that cage and this is what could happen. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue it right there as we continue to cover the trial for the murder of Tupac Shakur every single day. Press subscribe wherever you're listening or watching so you don't miss any of our coverage. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.